Welcome to Greens vs. Blacks, a weekly House of the Dragon podcast. I'm Joseph.
And I'm Michelle.
We're two House of the Dragon fans who have decided to rewatch and recap season one whilst we wait impatiently for season two. On the way, we'll explore the lore and mythology of Westeros and the rise and fall of House Targaryen. Right. Should we get going, Michelle?
I think we should just get straight into it. We did say we want to talk a little bit about our relationship with Westeros.
Our complicated relationships with Westeros.
Our history of Westeros and how we came to our love of House of the Dragon.
I feel like I'm coming out to my parents for a second time.
No judgment here.
So, I should say I'm a fantasy nerd. I have been one my whole life. I was the child that got the Silmarillion out of the library rather than Charles Dickens or children's books.
Fair enough.
I started to watch Game of Thrones when it first came out and absolutely loved the series. Didn't rewatch it for probably about 2-3 years afterwards, but then I think I rewatched it about 2-3 times and then I got stuck into the books and I've read 5 of the books. We're still waiting for...
There are only 5.
There are only 5 and the last one was in 2011. It's incredible that that's over a decade ago. We're waiting for number 6, which is due out imminently? Maybe?
No one knows. It was due out during the original broadcast and it's still not out.
We're going to be really interested to see what George R.R. Martin does now that the TV series is wrapped up. Where's he going to go? Anyway.
I mean, obviously, we kind of know the broad strokes of how Game of Thrones ends, but clearly there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the detail of how that show wrapped up. My relationship with Game of Thrones, I started watching it when it originally aired. I missed the first episode, I think, and sort of came in on the second one. Is that right? Or maybe I came in on the first one. I seem to remember anyway, just being like, oh my goodness, what is this? You know, that opening scene, that giant wall, zombies, blue eyes, small children. What's going on?
Sucks you right
okay,
in.
this is something that I've never seen before. And I am, like you, a fantasy nerd. I mean, the first books I remember reading were the Narnia books. I read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe when I was about 3. So, yeah, I am a total fantasy nerd.
You were a precocious child.
A precocious fantasy nerd.
Okay, so you felt completely at home.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. Everything about it. I wanted a direwolf. I wanted a big furry cloak.
I can see that for you.
I wanted everything. I want dragons. I want the lot. So I absolutely fell head over heels in raptures with Game of Thrones. And even with the dissatisfaction of the later seasons, I've still done a rewatch pretty much every year since. And during COVID, I rewatched the whole thing. And then I've rewatched it again since COVID. And I sometimes just watch an episode just for shits and giggles.
Do you know what? I'm exactly the same. I'll be reading something about something completely different. Mm. And they'll mention a Game of Thrones episode and they'll say, oh, do you remember in season 5, episode 3, when they visited old Valyria?
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh.
Stone Men. Let's go and check that out.
I need to go and, find out what Jorah and Tyrion were
or
up to.
Let's watch that really weird scene where Dany and Jon first get it on.
Yeah. Maybe not so much, but...
Also to say that I've also read all the books and to share your frustration at the lack of an ending. And then when Fire and Blood came out, I read that because I was like, oh, it's a way to get back into Westeros. I've also read The World of Ice and Fire. And then when House of the Dragon, because there were several prequels, I can't say that word, prequels.
Well done.
That were announced. There was going to be one from the Golden Age of Heroes. I think there was going to be one with Naomi Watts. And then House of the Dragon. And I was absolutely delighted when these were announced.
Yes, I remember them being announced. But the Naomi Watts show isn't going
ahead,
is it?
That's not happening. But there is talk of this Jon Snow sequel. Kit Harington is quite keen to return to Westeros. And one of the things I loved the most about the early seasons in particular, and I think we share this, is the politicking, which kind of gets minimised as you go along because it becomes more of an action show. And then it's like, right, we've got to wrap up lots of storylines. But initially, there's lots of lurking in corridors and people muttering and lots of whispering and who's pulling whose strings. You never really know who's good, who's bad. It's very grey. I think with House of the Dragon, that shares a lot of that DNA. And it's one of the things I really, really loved about it.
I completely agree. I mean, something that really pulled me in very quickly with House of the Dragon was the courtly intrigue aspect of it. Like you say, it's all about who's puppeteering, who's controlling this, and what's the long game.
And are any of them actually in control? I mean, that's one of the questions I kind of have as we go through the recap, because I think Otto is an interesting character, but we'll come to him.
Yeah, exactly. What happens when these egos go unchecked? Mm. It's completely. Very interesting. I should say, I've not read Fire and Blood, so I bow down to you as our resident law maiden.
Law whore.
Law whore. I think you needed to say that
not
first.
Not a maiden, whore.
Own it.
Poor and proud.
So there might be moments when we want to compare the book to the show. We might want to bring in various aspects of the literature.
And I have my copy of Fire and Blood here, so we can refer to it. Now, one thing I will say is, as many people will probably know, but people who are pure TV watchers won't, is that Fire and Blood is not a novel. It's much more like a kind of encyclopedia/history. So I think the whole of the story of the first season of House of the Dragon is only something like 10 or 15 pages of Fire and Blood. And it's very dry. So it's a bit like reading the Bible and then trying to work out, like, how was Moses feeling when he came down with those tablets from Mount Sinai? It doesn't really go into emotions or...
It's very much a chronicle.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I struggled to get into it. I'm about 2 chapters in and I am going to go back and have another crack at it. But yeah, obviously for the TV series, they've had to explode and expand.
And I think
it
works so well because you couldn't make a TV series of that. It would be really dull.
I suppose my question for you, if you can answer it, is we're on volume 1 of Fire and Blood at the moment. There's a volume 2 coming.
Yep.
So volume 1 came out in 2018, 19, something like that. And George is planning another volume. I'm just wondering, have you seen The Rings of Power, the Amazon Prime adaptation?
I have seen The Rings of Power.
Which is set to run for 5 seasons. Now, that is a series that's based on about 15 pages of text. And they've gone pretty non-canonical.
Yes.
Which is a big deal 100%. For some fans. There's elves and watchtowers and parts of the world that don't exist in the book. Characters that don't exist.
Characters that do exist have
disappeared. Storylines that don't exist. I'm just wondering... Are we going to see the TV adaptation of Fire and Blood, House of the Dragon? Are we going to see that be a lot more canonical, do you think, than The Rings of Power?
Well, George R. R. Martin is involved in it as a producer.
He is.
So I think the Tolkien estate is just so weird, and the politics of that. You've got some of the Tolkien's quite keen on TV. Others hate it. Amazon were just only allowed to adapt the appendices. But then apparently what they've allowed them to do is to go back and say, I know we're only supposed to adapt the appendices, but can we mention... X. And if they can justify it, then they'll say yes. It's well known that Tolkien didn't really like film and TV adaptations. He felt that they flattened and sort of dumbed down his work.
They can do, if you've not got the right producer running the show. I really want to know now how the Tolkien estate makes its decisions. We're going completely off-piste.
Yes, but I like going off-piste. I mean, I think it's actually not totally off piece because these were released at the same time. Amazon decided to go head to head with Game of Thrones, and I think they came off worst.
Yeah.
We're looking at a June release date for House of the Dragon, and I have suddenly seen that Rings of Power is now meant to be coming out this year, which I didn't think it would. But I think it would make a lot of sense for them to do that in the autumn and just leave the fantasy space free for House of the Dragon and not try to fight for the same audience. I think the conversation around House of the Dragon was so much more vibrant online than it was around Rings of Power. The Rings of Power was kind of okay. It was just a bit vanilla.
It got quite a lot of hate compared to House of the Dragon, which received almost universal acclaim.
Some of the hate was ridiculous, though. I mean, some of the hate was racist hate.
The usual thing of you can't have black elves. And, well, actually...
They're not real. They can be any colour.
They're fictional characters.
It's like you can't have a Doctor Who who's a woman. They can be an alien with 2 hearts, but they can't be a woman.
Yeah, that's a step too far. I'm sure we'll talk about that more.
Oh, yes.
As we talk about House of the Dragon.
Completely. Well, I mean, obviously House of the Dragon does some interesting things around race too.
Yeah.
Which were much less criticised. So it's interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay, should we get going?
So let's dive into the recap. Yes. I think that's enough of preambling. Is that a word?
Yeah, we've preambled well.
So in the first episode, one of the things that you might have noticed, I certainly did, was that there was no title sequence. There's just a voiceover and some scene setting. So it starts by saying, House Targaryen are at the height of their power in Westeros. They have 10 full-grown dragons. So essentially, they have the nuclear codes. They're basically up against...
They're totally in control.
Yeah, they're up against basically a bunch of cavemen with stones while they're on their dragons. King Jaehaerys, who has ruled the realm for about 60 years, I think, by this point.
60 years of peace.
Yes. He is dying and he has no heir. So he calls on all the great houses of the kingdom to come together and choose one. There are loads and loads of contestants, but it comes down finally to his eldest granddaughter, Rhaenys, and his grandson, Viserys. obviously, Westeros being a patriarchy, but it votes overwhelmingly for Viserys, who doesn't look particularly delighted, and his wife, Emma, is heavily pregnant. She doesn't look too pleased either. As this announcement is made, the Game of Thrones theme plays in the background, and then we cut to the Targaryen sigil. And then to some text, which very, very deliberately mentions Daenerys Targaryen. So we know where we are.
We know where we are. And for anyone who doesn't know where they are, this is roughly 200 years before the events of Game of Thrones. And we get in that opening credit the text that says it's 172 years before Daenerys Targaryen is born.
Yeah.
So we're making that direct link, like you say.
And with the music as well, and the sigil and all of those things. I mean, I will say the words call back quite a lot in this episode, but I think they do a very, very good job of doing that, because I think they know people love Game of Thrones, even with all its issues, people loved it. And so taking us back and plunging us straight back into that world, it's like a comforting blanket in a weird way. Yeah. You just feel like you're in safe hands. I know where I am. I'm in Westeros. And I was so happy to be back in Westeros.
Yeah, me too. I have to say, no title sequence. At first, I thought maybe they just shot this as a pilot. Maybe this just went
maybe
to the
Maybe there just never will be any title sequence.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
We've talked about the Game of Thrones title sequence before. It's a bit of a mood. It goes on. And it certainly gets you ready, gets your juices flowing for the show. But it's quite nice just to go straight into the action.
The thing I liked about the Game of Thrones title sequence, though, is the maps, which I think are very helpful. It gives you some idea of and there was a lot of complaints in later seasons about people jetpacking. But especially in the earlier seasons, you get this real sense of the scope and scale of the continent and where all these different places are. And also there was the way that the different emphasis was placed on. So we know, okay, we're not going over to Essos this week, or we're going to be in the Dothraki town or wherever. You got some idea of what was going to happen. And then as the seasons went on, I mean, the final season where they had like burnt ruins of castles. And so you could see, right, that's where the ice zombies, whatever they're called, the Night King.
Yeah.
They've come down to this point. So you could just sort of work out what was going on. It always really got me in the mood, and the music was so stirring.
Yeah. I completely have forgotten who the composer is for the series, but
Ramin Djawadi. I'm going to look it up.
They've done an incredible job. All of the incidental music, the main theme music, the character themes and leitmotifs, it's almost Wagnerian in terms of the detail, like the characters who have three different songs and bits of music. It's very, very cleverly done and helps steer the mood, I think, of the show perfectly.
Ramin Djawadi.
Thank you, Ramin. You've done an incredible job. When we start, we should say we're 100 years into 100 years since Aegon's conquest of Westeros.
So, I mean, obviously we will recognise the sigil.
Yeah.
Do you understand why the dragon has three heads?
Yes. So, okay, maybe, but as the lore whore, you can correct me on this, or you can educate me rather. So it's all referencing Aegon's conquest.
Yes.
And it's the three dragons that he and his sisters use.
Sister wives.
Sister wives. Welcome to Westeros. Please take a seat. He and his sister wives used to conquer.
Yes. So Aegon rode Balerion.
Yeah.
Who is now dead. And then his two sisters were Visenya. And my brain is gone for the other one. But we get a mention of Visenya later on.
Michelent.
If only. Visenya was the older sister and she's like the kind of warrior. And then the younger one, whose name I can't remember, was like the one that Aegon actually really loved. But because he had two, he kind of married both of them.
Yeah, obviously.
And it made sense because no one could go up against these three dragons. The interesting thing about the Targaryens as well was that in old Valyria, where they came from, they were not a particularly high house.
Okay, I did not know that.
Yeah, they were sort of middling of the dragon lords. And what happened was that their family were known for being dreamers. So they were like, had these kind of Cassandra-like visions. And they knew that something was going to happen in Old Valyria. And so they set up a base in Dragonstone, which is why that's where they began. And that's why that's kind of their home.
Do you know what? I did know this, because Valyria, old Valyria, has been built into the side of a volcano and it ends up collapsing before Aegon does his conquest. That's the reason why there's all this kind of like flight into new lands. And we don't know an awful lot about
that. Nobody really knows why. It's just called the Doom, and it's just this mystery. So this is why the dragon lords come over to Westeros, and obviously they set up on Dragonstone and they have their like little base there. And the Valyrians, another family we're going to meet, they're also from old Valyria, but they did not have dragons.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's why they become like the ship.
Right.
Family.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think this is one of the things that I love about this world, is that there is this richness and this real sense of history. It's not just like Anyway, whoever did something about 20 years ago, it doesn't really matter. I've heard George R.R. Martin described as a gardener. That's his technique when he writes.
Right.
So he plants lots of seeds and then they all kind of flourish. And
they all have their season.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Cool. I like that.
Yeah.
I have to say, in this opening scene, I really felt sorry for Rhaenys because obviously her father, Aemon, was the acknowledged crown prince, but he died a couple of years before, some years before.
Yeah.
He got into a minor skirmish with a Mirish pirate.
Minor skirmishes can be deadly.
They can be deadly. I think he got a crossbow to the neck or something like that. But it's clearly just rampant sexism denies Rhaenys her place, her rightful place on the throne. And Eve Best, the actor playing Rhaenys, does a really good job of keeping composed.
She's fantastic. I think she's a really great character. And I actually think when we see how this all plays out, I think she would have made an excellent queen.
How did you feel about Viserys being given the kind of line of succession?
Well, he was also a grandson. And I guess inevitably, I mean, in a weird way, it was kind of the fact that they even voted on it, that Jaehaerys didn't just go, nah, boy, you'll do. Was kind of a weird form of proto-democracy.
Yeah, I guess so.
But obviously in this world, you were never going to get a fair hearing. And we don't really see very much of how that process works. I mean, were there hustings? Did they go around with little leaflets? I mean, you know, was she riding around on her dragon knocking on doors?
Were there strict rules about parliamentary budgets for campaigning?
And the other thing is that though we don't really see much of this, Viserys did actually ride Balerion, the Black Dread. And so if you're sort of buying into that mythology, he rode Aegon the Conqueror's dragon. I think Balerion pretty quickly dropped dead after that.
Okay.
And Viserys never takes another dragon, but he did have that once around the palace.
I was going to say, the other thing that came to mind about the vote was Jaehaerys has form in the sense that he was actually put on the throne when Maegar the Cruel, his uncle, died. And he skipped in front of, I think, was it Maegar's children?
I'd imagine no one would have wanted Maegar's children anywhere near the throne.
No, they were like children, but there's form there.
Yeah.
He's done this before.
And I think there are so many things where the people of Westeros, the native Westerosi, kind of put up with the Targaryens and their nonsense because they have power. But I think there are points at which they're just like,
nope. No more psychopaths.
No more incest. All of them.
Or maybe just incest at 10%.
Incest for them, but not for anyone else. Because that's obviously with Cersei and Jaime. It's like the Targaryens married brother to sister all the time. That's one thing. But native born Westerosi, that's why there's such a negative reaction to Dany, because it's like, oh, she wasn't born here. She doesn't know our ways.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely those the kind of people who are from Westeros ancestrally tolerate some of the Targaryen shenanigans, but they don't love them. In this generation of Viserys and Rhaenys, they're only married to cousins, which is slightly less creepy.
Only slightly less creepy. I feel like they're moving in the right direction.
Yeah,
maybe by season three we could see.
It's pretty much like Victorian Britain. I mean, you look at Victoria's children marrying into every royal family in Europe.
Yeah, they literally just looked at the different branches of the royal families and said, who can marry who without it being too genetically catastrophic?
And that's why they all got haemophilia, because Victoria was a carrier, and she passed it on to her daughters, and then they passed it on to their sons. So that's why the Tsar of Russia, the Tsarevich, had haemophilia, and there are a few others, I think. So yeah, I mean, inbreeding and royalty, they kind of go together.
It's generally bad, y'all.
Yeah. Yeah, don't do inbreeding.
Can we just talk about the sigil really quickly?
Yes.
Three-headed dragon. I was reading something really interesting online. Someone was saying, so the Targaryens only adopted the heraldic sigil and the banners after Aegon's conquest when they became part of Westeros. I'd love to know what they had before, if they had anything.
I don't know about that, to be honest. But one of the things I'm always intrigued by and kind of find quite amusing is that people always suddenly produce like masses of banners when they're ready to go to war, whatever the situation is. I'm always, who is making these banners? Where have they come from? I mean, like in Game of Thrones, when Dany conquers King's Landing, you know, and she burns it to the ground, and then there's like that scene of her walking through, but there are just these massive banners. And she's got this battle dress and everything. And it's like, where's this all come from? Who's plaiting her hair? How?
And where is it being stored?
Yeah.
When you look around the scene previous, where is this stuff? Where's the warehouse?
I mean, it kind of made sense when the Starks take Winterfell back, because obviously it was their house. So you assume that someone's just shoved it in
a
cellar.
They're going to have some on hand.
And they've just got it back. But other things, I'm just like, where did the, how have they got this? Where did it come from? It's like, yeah, suddenly somebody's sitting up all night sewing frantically. My brain always goes to these old things, but I do. I think that's really interesting. Again, you know, that they're doing that synecritism. Is that the word?
I've never heard of that word.
Where you take, you know, like how religion, when Christianity spread through Europe, they sort of adopted, like, Easter was originally a fertility.
Right. Okay.
So they sort of overlay
kind of a pagan themes, and
but they kind of overlay it to make their version of it more palatable.
Yes.
So I think that's kind of what the Targaryens were doing. It's like, we're coming in, we are conquerors, but we also, we don't want to come in and just like lay waste, because they needed, there weren't enough of them. They needed the great houses of Westeros to kind of bend the knee and come to their side, because otherwise they would just have sat there in King's Landing and starved to death.
And I guess adopting a sigil and heraldic banners was just part of that campaign.
Yeah, propaganda.
Yeah. Mm. Bit of sewing.
Absolutely.
Bit of cloth.
Those two sisters.
Small
got
price
to be good
to
for something.
Okay, shall we move on to the next scene?
Yes. So we're now 9 years into Viserys' reign, and we open with a dragon's eye view of King's Landing. And I mean, it's just, it starts off in the clouds and it's just amazing. And then this yellow dragon kind of shoots past the camera, flying overhead as Dany's theme plays. We land in the courtyard of the Dragon Pit, which obviously we've seen before, but this is the Dragon Pit in its full glory as a working stable. And some handlers come out and they speak Old Valyrian to the dragon as a young girl, who we later find out she's supposed to be 11. A teenage Rhaenyra jumps off and pets it. And Rhaenyra is the daughter of Viserys.
And we should say Rhaenyra is brilliantly played by Millie Alcock.
Yeah.
I don't know if Millie's been in anything before, but I've not seen her.
I've seen her in a trailer for some comedy on Sky, but I haven't actually watched it. She's Australian originally as well, so she does the accent very well.
She does. She does it very, very well. And this is the first time we hear a bit of Old Valyrian, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, but I was very excited as a language geek.
I also really like the fact that the dragon handlers are all scarred and burnt.
Yeah,
obviously,
well, it's a hazardous
And you can see as they're speaking to Rhaenyra's dragon, which is called Syrax, there's a certain amount of trepidation. They're not kind of completely confident that they have control of this dragon, but it does do as it's told. And Rhaenyra pets it as if it was a horse when she jumps off.
Yes.
She strokes it. And I do love the reality. I think the dragon CGI is really good. The dragons feel weighty and real. And also one of the things that I really liked, which I always thought was bonkers in Game of Thrones, was that nobody ever thought of designing any kind of tack for these dragons. In the Targaryen height, they had saddles, which is obviously going to make it a lot safer.
And a lot more comfortable.
Yeah.
You know where to put your tush.
I always wondered what Dany was holding onto. Was she just like grabbing onto one of those horns?
It always looked really, really precarious.
Yeah.
I just envisaged a semi-comic scene of her falling off. Like, you know, like the old Superman films where someone got knocked off a skyscraper and he would dive down to collect them.
I think in that episode where she goes up and rescues them when they're all north of the wall, I think that does nearly happen. It comes close.
Yeah.
And, you know, you imagine the dragon suddenly dives or goes straight up. You've got nothing to hold on to. So I think saddles are an excellent idea, and I do.
Amen to saddles. I have to say, the CGI in House of the Dragon, it's a real step change from Game of Thrones. Obviously, we've got new technology, but they've done such a fantastic job. And that opening scene with the clouds, just the shadows and the perspective, everything just feels very chef's kiss.
And I think one of the things that they actually say later in the episode, Rhaenyra says, people see us as like gods. And you have to think, this is part of the reason why. No one else has been up here above the clouds. Everyone else is earthbound or water, you know, on water, but they're on the surface. And the Targaryens just get on these magical, mysterious beasts and can fly. And one of the things I thought was really interesting is like comparing, especially again with when Dany flies over King's Landing and everyone's shrieking because obviously she's murdering them. But when Syrax flies across, nobody bats an eyelid.
Yeah. Syrax apparently in this scene is 30 to 40 years old.
Oh, a baby.
At this point, he's just a baby.
Aww.
And dragons in Westeros can live up to 250 years old. Although I think there are.
I think Beleriand might have
older.
Lived longer than that.
Yeah.
But that was because Beleriand was the last dragon born in Old Valyria, I think, or who saw Old Valyria with his own eyes.
Should we talk about the other important person in the courtyard?
Yeah, so Rhaenyra is met in the courtyard by a Kingsguard, who we'll meet later, and Alicent Hightower, played by Emily Carey, and they ride off in a carriage through the city and back to the Red Keep. These two girls are obviously very close, very intimate, and they walk around holding hands, and they are best pals.
They are just like characters from the Babysitter's Club. They've got it going on. Rhaenyra clearly has a crush on Alicent. I thought it was a really nuanced depiction of girlhood. Not that I've ever been a girl, but that point kind of pre-puberty where everything's just like a bit confusing.
Yeah.
And it's going to get even more confusing.
I think anyone who's read like a Mallory Towers book or anything that, you know, the first formers always have crushes on the sixth formers, and it's that because you've got to direct your... those feelings somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's that brilliant line that Rhaenyra has, which is Cyrex will nearly be big enough to saddle too soon. Ooh. And I couldn't.
What a chat up line.
And Alicent is kind of maybe not. Well, her position is just a bit more precarious. She doesn't have that bandwidth for playfulness that Rhaenyra has.
I think the precariousness of Alicent's position and her general... That is going to come to play a lot as we go through the episode. We're going to see how exactly the differences of... even though Rhaenyra's a girl and clearly not destined for the life she would like, she's still a princess.
Yeah.
She has a status that Alicent does not, which again, we'll find out a bit more about that.
Yeah.
So we go to the Queen's bedroom and the Queen is heavily pregnant again. And she gives Rhaenyra a lecture about riding about on dragons and smelling of dragon, and that she should be quietly staying at home, sewing banners and getting ready for marriage, essentially.
Yeah. Can't disagree with that. I mean, Emma seems to have quite a level head. I just felt that this scene already, there was so much foreshadowing with Emma's talk about childbirth is our battlefield. Yeah. And yeah.
The royal womb is your currency and it's your job. I mean, that was actually, you know, to be fair, this is medieval England, in, you know, a palimpsest of it. Look at what happened to poor old Anne Boleyn.
And I think that another thing that's set up is Rhaenyra saying, I'd rather be a knight. I'd rather serve on the battlefield.
Yeah.
The actual battlefield.
And she, I think she's a little bit like Arya, who had that kind of whole, I don't want to be a lady. I want to be a fighter. I want to go and explore. I want to be. And I think that is the contrast as well between being a princess and also being a dragon rider.
Yeah.
It's like you're, in one hand, you're set up as this powerful potential warrior, and obviously she had that precedent with Aegon's sisters, so she must be looking at it and going, well, they fought, why can't I? But yeah, it's a different world.
Why could my blue stocking aunts do that and I've got to suddenly pump out the babies?
Yeah, but I guess it's a different world.
But that's going to be the big tension, isn't it, how she straddles those two things.
Yeah. And she has that wild Targaryen blood, well, which is another issue.
And is Emma half Baratheon?
No, Arryn.
Arryn, that's it. Yeah. She's a Vales lass.
Yes. That makes her sound like she comes from somewhere near Cardiff. She comes from the Eyrie. One thing I wanted to talk about here, which I think is kind of interesting, is, again, going back to the original series, the costumes in this are much simpler, especially the girls. And I think that does reflect on the fact that they are young. They are teenagers. But when you look at even some, like Cersei had those really long sleeves and the very elaborate hair. Did a little bit, had this sort of, does it look a little bit cheap in the beginning, some of the dresses?
I think it did. It looked a bit Cirque du Soleil knockoff.
Yeah. But then I also think the other thing is that obviously winter is not here. This is summer. It's King's Landing, A, and it's summer, B. And so they're just wearing quite casual clothes around the castle because they don't need to be all wrapped up in furs, and they don't have to, especially Rhaenyra, again, she doesn't have to have this like I am look at me all the time because she's the princess.
I really liked the costume straight off the bat, all of the kind of baseline cut dresses, and there was a lot of tunics. It felt more like a period drama, but just with enough of a kind of exotic point of difference with some of the stitching and colours used.
And the other thing is that at this point to note is that neither of them are wearing house colours.
No.
Rhaenyra's wearing a kind of yellow dress in that first scene. She's wearing dragon riding clothes initially, but when she's in the castle, she's wearing a kind of yellow dress. And Alicent, I think, is wearing kind of baby blue or just a kind of pale colour. But neither of them are in their house colours. Whereas when we cut to the small council, Viserys is very much in the blacks and reds. And he's got that kind of much more sort of armorial, heraldic kind of vibe. But he's the king. So Our first impression of Viserys as the king, I thought, was not a great one. He's telling a joke. And it's like, and he's middle off, and Rhaenyra runs in because obviously she is late. Her function is as a royal cupbearer, but her father tusks at her for being late, but they obviously have a very loving and affectionate relationship, and it's not really a problem. Now, at this point, some of the small council, who we will describe in detail, some of them are really desperately trying to actually steer the king's head back to business. So there is mention of the king's younger brother, Daemon.
Yeah.
And there's also Lord Corlys Velaryon, who we saw at the scene in Harrenhal. He is married to Rhaenys. Lord Corlys warns of an impending war somewhere called the Stepstones. But Viserys and his hand, Lord Otto Hightower, who's Alicent's father, only want to talk about the impending birth of this baby. Viserys is absolutely convinced that the baby will be a boy. He needs a boy. And the tournament that they're planning in the heir's honour. So what were our first impressions of this, the rest of the small council and Viserys for that matter?
I felt really sorry for Lord Corlys. He seemed to be the only person who'd shown up for work that day. And just kind of gets a bit of a nod and then they pass over it. They want to go back to telling jokes and talking about the tourney and the air and all of that kind of stuff.
And, you know, never count your chickens.
No, absolutely. This whole episode is about counting chickens before they hatch, isn't it? With tragic consequences. What did I think of Viserys? Well, can I say, what did I think of the rest of the small council? We should say who else is around the table. We've got Melos, who's the Grand Meister.
Yes.
We've got Lord Lyman Beesbury.
Love that name. Honestly, it sounds like my favourite flavour of cheesecake. I love it. I love it. I love it. he's played by Bill Paterson, who many people will recognise.
As Fleabag's father.
Yes, and in just television through the ages.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he's got a great job title, which is Master of the Coin. Just coining
just
it.
The just the one coin.
Just the one coin. It's huge, though, and it's chocolate on the inside. We've mentioned Prince Daemon Targaryen. He's Master of the Coin as well, and he's Master of Laws.
But he's kind of not really Master of anything because no one likes him. And I think this is the thing we get.
And he doesn't turn up to the meetings.
Yeah, we get quite clearly the sense that he is unreliable and no one is a fan of Daemon.
Yeah.
Viserys, you kind of get the sense that he's affable and a nice guy, but is he a good king? I think that.
I kind of felt like peacetime had gone to his head. You know, it's that old Bertolt Brecht quote about in peacetime, people even forget to name their children when they're born. It's just kind of a bit, he's a bit complacent. Like, where the hell is the security at the small council? I know, obviously, the guards are going to let Rhaenyra through. She's the princess. But people just come and go on this program all the time. This episode is a really good example of that. It's peacetime. I just kind of feel like everyone thinks the sun is going to be in the sky forever.
Yeah.
No one's really planning for war. Lord Corlys talking about what's happening on the steps.
Yeah,
that's just the beginning of
that.
Don't
be boring.
Yeah,
don't be boring, Corlys. We want to talk about party.
Don't plan ahead.
Yeah. And obviously, the other thing is that he is just so convinced that this baby is going to be the answer to everything. And once he has his heir, then that's fine. And it's like, even if you have an heir, one heir, your grandfather had two.
Yeah.
Did you not learn anything? It's no guarantees in this world.
Well, and they both died.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Because after the first one, Balon died quite quickly, didn't he?
And so there's absolutely, just because you have an heir, there's no guarantee that that heir is going to reach manhood. So,
but he's completely monomaniac about having a son.
Yeah.
He's obsessed with it. And that's all he can talk about. And I kind of feel like that meeting was just an extension of that mania.
And then we have Otto. What do we think about Otto?
Otto, who's brilliantly played by Rhys Iffens, I have to say. This is a definite step up from his role in Notting Hill.
He cut his hair at least.
He doesn't look like he's aged that much, actually. So Otto Hightower is the hand of the king. And for those of us who don't know, do you want to tell us a little bit about House Hightower?
House Hightower. Okay, so first of all, we should say Otto is a second son.
Yes.
He is not Lord Hightower in the sense of being like the head of the household.
Yeah.
He is the second son, so that's why he's here doing this job.
Yeah.
And I think, again, coming back to this sort of slight precarious position, you can be the hand and then you can be unhanded.
De-handed?
You can lose your job. And so obviously Otto's doing a very good job of essentially sucking up to Viserys pretty much all the time to keep him with him because this is his status in life. The Hightowers come from Old Town, which we may remember is where the Maesters are trained, and Sam and Gilly go there in Game of Thrones. And it's where Sam's cleaning out all those buckets of slop and vomit. And
yes, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And don't they have a big lighthouse?
They do have a big lighthouse, but we might want to save that for a later episode because it's kind of that it's important.
Okay.
But the other thing that we know is it's where all the Maesters go for their training.
Yeah.
And it's also where the ravens are sent from to say winter is coming. So you get a white raven.
Right.
And that's the official start of winter. So we don't, Hightowers seem to have disappeared as a house by the time of Game of Thrones, but they're obviously very important in this world. And they're kind of in the same neck of the woods as the Tarleys and the
Highgarden,
the Tyrells.
Tyrells.
Yeah.
They're another small house, aren't they? The Tyrells, I think, in Game of Thrones end up with about four members of the branch of the main family. And I think the Hightowers are in that kind of neck of the woods. It's kind of precarious.
Yeah. And also, you know, like I guess if a Hightower woman marries into a Tyrell family and then the rest of her family die, then they kind of just absorb that household as part of their own. We might have got that completely wrong. So if we have, forgive us. But they just are not part a key part of Game of Thrones.
We will undoubtedly get things wrong.
We will. There are so many names. Okay, so then we cut to Rhaenyra sneaking about, and the Kingsguard that we saw earlier, they're sort of muttering together, and Rhaenyra's saying, "Does my father know he's here?" And then they open the door to the throne room, and the Kingsguard kind of goes,
"Abomination."
Because Daemon is lounging insolently on what he calls the iron chair. He then gives Rhaenyra, they obviously get on well. They speak to each other in Old Valyrian.
They do.
And he gives her a gift of a necklace, which is made from Valyrian steel. We know that Daemon is technically the heir, but as Rhaenyra reminds him, if the baby is a boy, he will lose his position and be downgraded in the succession. The throne was a bit of a surprise the first time we saw it. It's not the same throne.
It's not. It's had a bit of a zhuzh, hasn't it?
A glow up.
I kind of feel like the a glow up. The Game of Thrones Iron Throne. Very much kind of like a peacock fantail design. It's quite compact.
Yeah, and also it was a bit disappointing because they talk about how it was like 1,000 swords or whatever. And then you look at it and you're like, really? It looks about like 100.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. But the throne here is just really, really going for it. I did a little bit of Googling, actually, to find out what George R.R. Martin thought of the throne. And apparently the throne in House of the Dragon is much closer to what he imagined. And he had worked previously with a French artist called Marc Simonetti, who did a lot of the illustrations for the World of Ice and Fire, which you mentioned. And this throne is a lot closer to the vision Simonetti had, which is interesting. I mean, when you look at Simonetti's original drawing, it's even more crazy. It's even more Baroque. It's 10 feet high. Mm. It's like a cross between a haystack and I kind of think like a pulpit. You know, this idea that you're preaching above everyone. You are
which
the voice
makes
of
sense.
God.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have to climb this little stepladder to get into it. I don't think that would have worked on the set.
Might have been a bit tricky. And of course, the idea of these swords is that these are the swords of the Knights of Westeros when Aegon conquers them.
Yeah.
They chuck their swords down and then Beleriand melts them and they melt into this throne.
And you can see a lot of those swords kind of tumbling down the steps. Well, they're kind of stuck in the stone, aren't they? It's a lot more dispersed.
And sort of organic.
Yeah, definitely. Do you know what? It gave me Geiger alien vibes, kind of, in a way.
Maybe.
Like it's like almost like an organism.
Maybe the throne in Game of Thrones, they took that one away and they brought out the kind of IKEA version. Because it would be more comfortable.
The throne-ette.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing, because the whole thing about the throne is it tests the king, doesn't it? It tests whoever's sitting on it. If you're not good enough, if you're not made of the right metal, it will hurt you.
Foreshadowing.
Absolutely. Mm. Foreshadowing what happens to Viserys. I love the fact that when we opened those doors, we just saw Matt Smith lounging on this bed of knives, rusty knives, as if it was nothing.
It's completely
Which really sums up his character.
It does. And his sort of general, not contempt, but...
It is a contempt for authority and structure and hierarchy.
Yeah. And also he just has this kind of like, oh, whatever. I mean, that is his vibe. It's essentially just a big old whatever. He has no time for that kind of pomp, and except when it suits him, because then he's like, I'm Prince Daemon. Listen to me.
I'm going to pull rank.
Yeah. But for anyone else's rank, he's just like, whatever. apart from that, I think there's interesting to see the scene and the synergy, the energy between him and Rhaenyra.
Yeah. It's a strange one, isn't it? Because it's an uncle talking to his niece, but it very much foreshadows how their relationship is going to develop. And there is something...
They're Targaryens.
They're Targaryens. Sister wives. and when Daemon gives Rhaenyra the necklace, he says, now both of us own a piece of our ancestry. And there's almost this idea that we are going to have to commit to each other at some point to continue the bloodline.
Yeah, they are dragon riders. They're Targaryens. This is what they do.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that when they're speaking intimately, they speak in Old Valyrian. And then when they kind of become more modern or less close, they switch to English or Westerosi, but in our version.
When they're saying their sweet nothings, it's Old Valyrian. Yeah. Yeah. When they're just ordering in from Just Eat, it's standard Mancunian English. Can we just talk about the Valyrian language briefly?
Yes.
Because
yes.
Obviously there's a lot more of it in House of the Dragon. I think there's like a few words or phrases in the books.
Yes.
And there wasn't very much in Game of Thrones. I think the most we got was when Daenerys would talk to Missandei.
Yeah, and Grey Worm.
Lieutenant Grey Worm. And they would communicate in Valyrian. And I think that was like a subsect of Valyrian that Missandei...
Yeah, and then there was a lot of, you know, Dany bellowing about being of the blood of old Valyria in Valyrian.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But with House of the Dragon, I think they've really gone for it in terms of making a very rich kind of linguistic landscape. They've got David J. Peterson, who I think worked on Game of Thrones. He's incredible. He's a linguistics expert and he has a really great YouTube channel called The Art of Language Invention.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I imagine inventing a language. That would be amazing.
So
not much use when you're the only one who can speak it, but hey.
Yeah, well, there's a Valyrian course on Duolingo now, isn't there? So before long, we'll be conducting official government business in old Valyrian. But he also created Dothraki and he created Astapori and Miranese.
Oh, wow.
Valyrian. So they have really kind of invested in that. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I love languages. I'm a bit of a language geek. I was really interested to read about that process of them creating Valyrian, because apparently it's the most developed invented language since Elvish.
Yeah, and I think also what's interesting is that this is, unlike with Tolkien, who've invented the languages and then kind of designed a world to fit the languages, this is the other way around.
Yeah.
So the world already existed and you could have done without the other languages. But I think it really helps to give you this sense that the Targaryens aren't from Westeros, you know, that they are alien, that they do speak another language and they can have these private conversations. Yeah. I mean, I don't know anyone who's ever kind of gone to visit friends whose parents speak another language and their family suddenly will start speaking in their own native tongue and you're just sort of sitting there. It's always really interesting because people who learn Irish at school and they would use it when they wanted to talk about people without them knowing what they were saying.
Yes. And you just give off a completely different vibe when you're talking that other language. I have memories of being with friends and I would think they're having a huge argument in Arabic.
No,
and then actually
it
was like, no, they were just saying, really good to see you. And do you want to stay for dinner?
I think also because Emilia Clarke got quite a lot of criticism for her performance. But one thing she was very good at was shouting in Old Valyrian.
She never lost the timbre, did she? She was very good at it. For me, High Valyrian is the Latin of Westeros.
Yes.
I think in terms of its kind of structure, the way it sounds, it's a little bit more exotic than that. And contrasting it against Dothraki, which sounds very Arabic, very Spanish, a bit of a mix. I'm hoping for lots more High Valyrian conversation.
I think
I want to be fluent by the end of the season.
Oh, Duolingo, there you go.
Yeah.
So we cut to Alicent and Rhaenyra reading, or Alicent is trying to test Rhaenyra on the reading that she should have done. And Rhaenyra clearly can't be bothered. And she's being naughty.
After my own heart.
Yeah, and Alicent is kind of going, you must take this seriously. And Rhaenyra's like, why should I?
It's just a pop quiz, Alicent. Stop being such a swat.
And this comes back, I think, a little bit to Alicent is the good girl.
Yeah.
But she also sort of has to be because of her position, as you're saying, with her father being second son. They don't have a house of their own. I mean, an actual physical house. They have a family house, but they don't have any property. They don't have any income, probably other than what her father earns as Hand of the King. So I think she's very aware that she needs to marry well, that she needs to do all the good stuff. She needs to follow that path.
Her eyes are completely on the horizon.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little bit of resentment that creeps in there early with that friendship where Rhaenyra is just about, you know, I want to eat cake for the rest of my life. I want to travel with you on a two-girl saddle. And like you say, Alison is thinking, what lessons can I learn from history? What's happening in politics? Who am I going to marry? What was my life going to look like tomorrow? So it's interesting to see that relationship build in those tensions from the start.
And I think she definitely loses patience with Rhaenyra here a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially as she knows how clever Rhaenyra is.
Yes.
And she knows that Rhaenyra actually, as we see, knows all of this stuff and is just pretending. Another callback is that the book they're reading, or the story that they're reading in the book, is the story of Nymeria, who was a princess of Dawn. And that is a name that we should recognise.
We do recognise that name.
Why do we recognise that name?
Because you've just said that we should. I recognise that name, but I cannot remember the link. Tell me.
It's Arya's wolf.
Oh, of course. Mm. Yes. Who then recognises her.
Yes.
Many years later.
And obviously Arya names Nymeria after Nymeria, the princess of Dawn, because Nymeria led her troops and conquered and fought in battles. So again, it's referencing this like badass girl that Rhaenyra wants to be, that Arya wants to be. Those parallels between how they see themselves and how the world sees them.
We love a bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Right, so we're on to Viserys.
Viserys is treated for a mysterious wound. The maesters suggest cauterizing it, and Otto is very worried that this must not get out and no one must find out about it. And this comes back to what you were saying about the throne. Viserys says dismissively, it's just a cut from the throne. But there is a superstition that the throne will reject and what it sees as an unworthy king. So obviously this is part of the reason why Otto is saying it mustn't get out. And the wound is not healing. It's just sitting there getting more and more disgusting.
I mean, there's two messages there. Viserys, up your game as king. Clearly, even inanimate objects now are casting you out as a wastrel. And also, fix your posture. Maybe a yoga
block.
Sit
up straight. Maybe put a cushion on the throne or a nice blanket.
Treat yourself. You are king after all.
I'd put a blanket on it.
I would say a nice throw.
Yeah, or just stand next to it. You don't have to sit on it.
Exactly. Just be there for photo opportunities.
It's here, but it's not very comfortable.
We do see cauterization, which is quite graphic. I mean, this episode is quite body horror graphic, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot more to come.
We're still in the foothills of the nastiness at this point. This pus is quite unpleasant too.
Bizarre historical fact. Do you know that cauterization used to be used by surgeons? Well, I say surgeon, I use that word lightly.
Barber surgeons.
Barbers. Mm. Pig spayers. to treat cancer and epilepsy.
It makes sense. Burn it out.
Yeah. Well, didn't make sense to me, but now you've said that.
Well, I mean, in that mindset, you just burn things out. I guess they thought fire was cleansing.
Yeah. So we're on to...
Well, we now cut to Emma and Viserys. Viserys goes to visit her in the bath, which is the only place that she's comfortable, which is a little bit foreboding that this baby is not sitting where it ought to be sitting.
There's a lot of problematic births in Fire and Blood, sadly.
Funny that when you have sex with your cousins and your sisters.
And they all end up with webbed feet that...
Well, some of them, they say, come out like little weird dragons, but yes.
Wasn't that Dany's baby?
But that was that witch said that. That was something different. So we don't rely on her. She was a liar.
She was a piece of work.
She certainly was. So Emma says, I'm tired. I've done enough now. She's had lots and lots of miscarriages and lots of dead babies, and she doesn't want to do it anymore. Viserys is still telling this story of how this is going to be the boy. And he tells her about the vision that he had, the dream where there was clashes of swords and the baby came forth and all the dragons roared as one, which is quite poetic. And Emma kind of goes, okay.
Emma's just feeling worn down. She's completely in her body. What I did think was, it's so nice that they have such a touching, close, intimate relationship. But again, foreshadowing.
They do genuinely seem to love each other.
They do.
Which I think is unusual in medieval times.
Yes, and Emma seems to have a lot of agency and isn't worried about answering back.
Yeah.
I mean, when Viserys says, I've had this big dream and it's going to be a boy, she says something like, oh, Rhaenyra says it's going to be a girl. Mm. Almost flippantly.
And she's picked out the egg already. The dragon egg, by the way, if in case you're like, what egg? Why is there an egg?
Why is there?
The Targaryens, not always, because obviously Syrax is older than Rhaenyra. So
do they go near the cradle of the child?
I think sometimes you have a like already grown or half grown dragon, but often they give them an egg, and then the egg, the
it's
idea
like
is the egg is supposed to hatch
and
be their dragon.
Yeah.
So yeah, poor Emma. I mean, obviously her body's absolutely exhausted. So as we discussed, the small council were unimpressed with Daemon, but they do give him a role because he has to have something to do rather than just like wandering around causing mischief. So they make him commander of the City Watch. He takes this and runs with it. So we see Daemon winding up a bunch of men and then essentially just sending them out to on a raid.
On a hunt.
Yeah, to kill and maim with impunity. They find people, they say, you're a raper, you're a thief.
Sorry, not a raper, a raperist.
No, raper.
Oh, did they
raper.
Actually say raper?
Raper.
That's it. Stealist.
And they're chopping off hands and they're chopping off genitals and they're chopping off heads. And they essentially just run through King's Landing, killing, stabbing, chopping, and having a great time.
There's no habeas corpus. There's no innocent until proven
not
guilty
in Westeros.
Not even
the slightest attempt of to trial.
And they cut off so many appendages, I'm using the polite term, that Otto says at some point they needed two horse carts to carry away all of the dismemberments.
Nice, dismemberments.
Dismemberments,
that's a good
that's
word.
That's lovely.
So the small council are then outraged, obviously. Because
obviously.
What does Daemon think he's doing? And Viserys points out slightly irritably that it was their idea to give him this job. So as always, they've underestimated just how bonkers Daemon can be. Daemon is there in the small council meeting at this point, covered in blood, which obviously he should have had a wash before he came in. So this is another example of his general disrespectfulness and his attitude.
Well, and he knows his brother's going to put up with it.
Yeah.
He knows Viserys is going to find an excuse for him. And in fact, when he ends up insulting Otto, there is a little bit of smirking going on between the brothers. Yeah. It's horseplay.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like the small council are in a difficult position in a way. Obviously, Daemon's the loved brother of Viserys, so they have to tread carefully. But even with the City Watch, okay, he's a bit lawless, but he's taken them to 2,000 men.
Yeah.
He's given them their nice gold cloaks. So he's dressed them up, even if he can't have a wash himself. And he is, the way he puts it to the small council is, do you not want everyone in King's Landing to feel safe?
Yes.
I feel like this is a Tory politician speaking.
Or Rudy Giuliani. Zero tolerance.
For rapparists.
Yeah, but the thing is, what he's saying in a way is like, tourists are coming here. So for this tournament, there will be people arriving. We want the city to be clean.
Yeah.
We don't want rapists, thieves and murderers wandering around. And we don't want the tourists to come here and then give a bad review on TripAdvisor. So Daemon has a point. Obviously, it would have been nice if maybe he'd rounded those people up and put them in jail, but then maybe there isn't anywhere to put them. So it is a kind of tough justice.
And we do get the first mention of Lady Rhea Royce.
Yes.
Don't we? The bronze bitch.
His bronze bitch. Otto is poking at him, saying, why don't you go back to your wife? And Daemon basically says, if you want a wife, because Daemon obviously is aware that Otto's own wife has died recently, and he essentially says, you can have her. At which point Otto bristles and stands up, and then I think is rapidly reminded of his place. But also at this point, Daemon is still the heir.
Yes.
So this would be treason.
It would be treason.
A stupid thing to do. So Otto sits down and Viserys tells Daemon, essentially slaps him on the wrist and says, don't do that again.
It's kind of made a little bit more complicated as well by the fact that Emma arranged the marriage between Daemon and Lady Rhea Royce. And Rhea is from, she's an Arryn?
She's a Royce.
She's a Royce,
but they are bannermen of the Arryn.
That's it. So there's a close allegiance between those two families, and almost Daemon saying, well, I haven't seen my estranged wife who's a bit of a, you know, she hangs out in the Vale with the sheep shaggers. I haven't seen her for years. It's almost a slur on Emma as well.
Yeah.
So there's nuances there.
Well, I mean, essentially, I think, it comes back to Viserys being a little bit weak.
A little bit weak?
A little bit weak, and Daemon being a little bit disrespectful, and the two of them.
I feel like this is going to break into an Elvis Presley song.
No, but Viserys needs to put Daemon in his place, and he fails to do so. And I think the jury's still out a little bit on Viserys, but we are increasingly seeing that he's kind of got lucky. He's been a king in a time when he's not had to make hard decisions.
Yeah.
And so he just doesn't make hard decisions.
Okay.
We then cut to Daemon in a brothel trying to have sex.
End of the podcast. I mean, just one of the more uncomfortable scenes in GOT, in House of the Dragon.
So
just
uncomfortable. Why is everyone watching him?
And also, I mean, Sonoya Mizuno as well. That poor woman.
No.
Just awful. Well, yeah. Why is everyone watching him? I guess that was the way they did things back then.
But I kind of felt I would have had performance anxiety with that many sets of eyes.
Oh my God. I mean, I can't go at urinal if there's someone within 200 miles.
So basically, something's up. Or down.
Or just
not up.
Undecided.
Yeah. Something is not working for Damon. And he's obviously not very happy. And the sex worker, who we'll later find out is called Lady Miseria, wraps him in a blanket and kind of pats him and says, it's all right.
Treats him like a little errant toddler.
Yes. But he's obviously, you know, he puts on this big show.
Yes, he does.
And then at other times he clearly...
And then he can't live up to it. But that's... I kind of feel like that's this whole first season is Damon is a very tortured character behind the scenes.
Yes.
And kind of it feels like he doesn't always believe the aggravation that he causes. He doesn't always... You know, he's not 100% behind it.
But I also think he's got that classically insecure thing of like, I am... bigger than I am, because inside I'm
the second. He performs and bangs his chest.
Yeah, I'm the second son. No, you know, I'm the spare. Nobody really wants me. Nobody really likes me.
The Prince Harry of Westeros.
So I've got to pretend that this is all water off a duck's back.
But actually, I'm a hurt little boy.
But actually, he clearly is not.
Yeah,
is not as confident as he pretends.
Can we talk very briefly about Miseria?
Yes.
So Miseria in the books is a dancer from Lys. And she's described in the books as being quite light-skinned. She's got pale hair, pale skin. I thought this was a really nice piece of, what would you call it? I think of like gender-blind casting. What is
colour-blind.
It? Colour-blind. Mm. Yeah, colour-blind casting. I was really happy to see Sonoya Mizuno. I thought she was amazing in Maniac, and she's been in quite a few other things as well.
See, the only thing I've seen her in is Deus Ex Machina. Not Deus Ex, Ex Machina.
Yes.
Yeah, in which she is amazing, but doesn't really say very much.
No, she's definitely got a presence in that. Mm. Have you seen Devs?
No, but I've heard that she's really good in Devs.
It's very, very good. Yeah. And she's the lead character in Devs, so definitely watch that. Can we talk a little bit about her accent?
Her accent kind of bothers me a bit.
As in, does it give you a twitchy eye? Or
slightly, because it's just sort of like generic exotic.
Yes. What I thought, it might have been based on something like Haitian Creole, or there's a little bit of a... I mean, she's only been in Westeros for 3 years at this point, so who knows? She could lose that accent, but it's got a lot of traction online. A lot of people have criticised it. If the House of the Dragon production team is taking the time to build up the kind of linguistic universe this time round, why would you have chosen that accent?
I mean, because even in Game of Thrones, I mean, Varys is from Essos.
Yes.
Missandei is from Essos. They don't have these strange accents.
No, they sound a bit Essex sometimes, but...
I think Conleth Hill might be from Ireland.
Okay.
But they don't have... And I know, obviously, Varys has been in Westeros for a long time, but Missandei's a translator in Essos.
Yes.
And she doesn't have this weird accent. Or they could have sort of looked at the way Grey Worm and the Unsullied spoke and maybe used something. I just think it would have made more sense if they'd kind of grounded it. Her accent is just like exotic from nowhere in particular.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's where it does feel a little bit odd, because it just doesn't seem to fit into the kind of schema that we've built up so far.
Do you know what? I think that's it. It just sticks out a bit too much, but maybe it will bed in.
And she also has a kind of lisp, a little bit like that.
Moving swiftly on.
So, finally, we're at the birthday tournament. Will this be fun?
Hurrah!
Hurrah! It's going to be so much fun. It's going to be chivalric and honourable and gorgeous.
Obviously.
This is Game of Thrones world. It will not be.
Well, can we just start off with straight away?
The big vagina-shaped arena.
I was not going to go straight to the vagina.
Why not? It's Game of Thrones.
Well, I was going to say, okay, we're in the wider Game of Thrones universe, but this is House of the Dragon and they have got money.
Oh, yes.
Like, Game of Thrones, love it. Guys, you did a fantastic job. But my God, if I had to see one more garden centre marquee and a bit of old, you know, trellis fencing, I was going to go a bit crazy. This time around, I mean, they've got like $50 million extra
to spend
on CGI.
Well, if you compare this with the sad little tournament for Ned when he arrives at King's Landing, where everything's kind of made out of 2x4s.
Yeah.
It's like, this is another universe. This is the Targaryens, as we've said, at the height of their power.
Absolutely.
And this is a celebration of their status, wealth, and just their general kind of godlike status in Westeros. And it is fantastic. I mean, the crowd is huge. The arena is huge. It's all going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of action there. And yeah, you're just making me laugh thinking about Ned's tawny. It reminded me, actually, I'm like conjuring up visions now. I've clearly put it to the back of my mind. But it was like one of those play parks that little boys and girls go to learn about woodwork.
Or like, you know, when they have that Dismaland thing. Or one of those, you know, where the people turn up to go to this like Christmas extravaganza.
And they end up suing the organisers.
There's like one elf smoking around the back of the shed.
Trying to find a vein with Santa.
I mean, it was just really, really, you can't compare it, and you can just see, I mean, the difference, obviously, I think in particular in season one of Game of Thrones was no one knew if this was going to be successful. So HBO were not chucking money at it. Whereas this time around, they've obviously just gone
license to print money.
Go, go, go and have fun. So it is amazing and it is very, very grand.
It is.
The other thing that is nice and call back again, but we hear those callback. We hear those houses named. So we hear the Baratheons named. We hear a lot of other names that will be familiar from our last trip to Westeros.
Yeah.
And so once again, we're being grounded in this world and it's like, oh yeah, familiar, familiar, familiar places and names. The banners, the sigils, all of it. It just feels like, okay, I know where I am.
And there's just so much going on in this scene, isn't there?
Daemon's helmet. Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, let's talk about Daemon's helmet, which is made of Valyrian steel.
But how ridiculous is it?
It's just... It's like, it reminds me of those old films about the Greek gods, you know, like Apollo?
Yeah.
It's just Apollo on acid.
Yeah, it's completely over the top.
It's not practical.
No, not at all. And you sort of think, wouldn't you just kind of grab it and yank it off? But as it happens, and again, Daemon with his attitude, he chooses his first joust. He picks Otto's son.
Yeah, Gawain.
We don't think there's anything in that, do we?
It's completely innocent. Just pulling a name out of a hat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't want to wipe out another branch of the family.
Clearly he hates Otto and his hatred of Otto is becoming more and more obvious. He cheats in the joust.
He uses his lance sideways, doesn't he,
he trips his horse.
Yeah.
And then has the gall, having done that, leaving poor Gawain. Leaving poor Gawain like on the ground, he trots over to Alicent and asks for her favour as he just dehorsed her brother.
Well, and it's a hat trick because whilst this is all happening, Otto is kind of giving side eye to Viserys as if to say, do you not think you should say something? I mean, I kind of felt like this whole scene was principally to show how little control Viserys had over Daemon and the kingdom.
And the whole thing, it just goes wild.
Yeah.
I mean, it starts off quite wild and then it gets wilder and wilder and wilder. And I think it's only Rhaenys and Corlys are sitting there going, this has gone too far. Everyone else seems to be quite down with it. They're laughing and chatting and enjoying themselves. And those two are kind of like, yeah, this is a bit much.
Well, there's that big contrast. So at the start of the scene, we've got Rhaenyra and Alicent kind of chatting away about which of the ladies of court is hiding her pregnancy bump and...
Yeah, bit of gossip.
Who's in love with who. And then by the end of it, Alicent's right on those cuticles. Like really mesmerized by the violence. Because I thought at the start, wow, these girls are really desensitized. And they probably are quite a bit. But you've got that page boy being sick. You've got the whole scene just descending into chaos as these supposedly respectable knights start hacking away at each other.
Yeah. And I think this is when Rhaenys says they've never been to war. And they've got, obviously, too much testosterone.
Jesus.
They need to do something. You know, and obviously, they hadn't invented football. So this is the answer.
Well, I mean, I go to a kickboxing class, maybe some gardening, a long walk.
So we also meet another new character in this scene.
Oh, yes. And no one really knows about him, do they?
No, it's a mystery.
But it's fine. Because he's got smouldering brown eyes and Oscar Isaac hair.
He's very handsome.
So people give him the green light. So Kristen Cole.
So Kristen Cole from Dawn. Now, Alison really remarks on this like it's super significant. I was never really quite sure why. She kind of goes, oh, he's Dawnish.
Well, she knows her history, doesn't she? Mm. And with Aegon's conquest, the only people who really put up a serious fight were the Dornish.
Yes.
And that's why the Dornish Wars happened, obviously.
Yes.
So I just wondered if she bristled at that. Like, oh, he's a double outsider.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's sexy.
He is sexy. It has to be said.
Yes.
And he takes on Daemon, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, the tournament, we've said, is brutal, but nothing compared to the birth.
Oh, my God.
And this is, you know, I don't like the phrase trigger warning very much, but I mean, I think this program features scenes of childbirth is an understatement. It is horrendous.
I just thought it was going to be a sweaty woman in a tunic, rolled up to her knees, crying a bit. That when I heard that announcement at the start, nothing prepared me for this scene, which I think is one of the goriest and most disturbing, psychologically disturbing scenes I've seen in Game of Thrones.
Yes,
and the Game of Thrones world.
And when we talk about hard decisions.
Well, this is the acme of hard decisions.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's horrendous. It is absolutely horrendous. Basically, the baby is stuck. It's not coming out.
Yeah.
Emma is obviously tired. And Viserys is told by the Maester that they've read about, I think, I don't even think they've ever tried it, but they've read about a procedure where they could save the baby or lose mother and baby.
It's a technique that they've learned in the Citadel.
Yeah, but they've probably only ever done it on a corpse.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is some sort of rudimentary C-section.
Yes.
And Viserys, they have no anaesthesia.
Well, she's got milk of the poppy.
Yeah, but they've already said they've given her as much as they can.
And that's basically laudanum, isn't it? It's not going to cut it if someone's going to cut into you.
And they don't even attempt to knock her out. I mean, she's conscious while all this is happening. So Viserys, in his desperation for a baby boy,
And that scene, the way can we say he betrays Emma? Because he's whispering assurances to her. Mm. She's clearly scared. She's lost control of her body. She's got a very good idea of what's happening. But at the same time, she's losing that life force, that energy really quickly. And she's looking to Viserys just to hold her hand and be there for her. And there's that awful line, they're going to bring the baby out now.
Mm.
Which is just this really a shoddy euphemism
that was exactly
uses.
The word. It's like bring it out.
I don't want to tell you that I'm making the decision that's going to end your life.
And she knows because
she knows.
Yeah, she's being held down.
That look of horror in her eyes immediately. Yeah. I mean, it's just fantastic acting.
And the sheer kind of visceralness of that scene is horrendous. And it's cross-cut with what's happening in the arena. So you're just cutting from like people's heads being stoved in to back to Emma on this bed. And it's just, it's hard to say which is worse. But it's all just horrendous. Paddy Considine, could I just say, I don't think we've actually name checked him up till now.
We haven't.
Paddy Considine.
Hi, Paddy.
Is Viserys, and he is so good as Viserys. I think I've always really liked him as an actor and a director, but I just think he's just so good in this role.
He's just a really laconic actor.
Mm.
His delivery is not over, it's not hammy, it's not over tragic, but he's one of those actors who's really good at, in terms of his mood, keeping an even keel and just responding to the shit that's going down around
him. But then when
in a believable
he does
way.
Get cross, like, okay. We know that he means it now.
Yeah.
Because he saves it for
when
he's
it really
pushed.
Matters. Yeah, absolutely.
So we have Sir Criston and Daemon fighting. Criston fights with, I think it's a Morning Star or a mace. It's that like when you have a little handle and then you have like a spiked thing on a chain and you swing it round.
I want to say Morning Star.
Yeah, I think it's a Morning Star.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously Daemon fights with a sword and Criston beats him.
He does. And spares his life. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yes. But he sort of says yield and Daemon sulks and does.
Yeah.
Well, Rhaenyra seems almost turned on by all this. She seems to be quite enjoying it.
I guess she's of that age.
Yeah. And she gives her favour to Sir Criston.
Yes, she does.
She does. And Daemon sulks off because he's a bad loser. In the meantime, poor Emma has died. The baby is born. And nobody seems particularly, I mean, for obvious reasons, nobody seems particularly joyful. But also, I don't know whether I'm imagining this in the light of what comes later, but the Mace is holding the baby. You don't hear the baby crying, and it kind of does this little hiccupy sound.
This little gurgle.
Yeah.
This little ominous cough gurgle.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Viserys doesn't hold the child. No. It's not placed near the mother. It's with the Maester. It's a weird scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's over so quickly.
And also, this was the thing. This was why we were doing all of this, was to have this boy. And then this boy is just kind of...
But he's just in the background being held by a stranger. And I guess it's a Pyrrhic victory because Viserys is there still holding Emma's hand, sobbing into her body.
So obviously, at this point, the word starts to get around, like people are coming out and going, Otto, Otto, you know, and people, more and more people sort of disappearing out of the royal box. And then we cut to the funeral, which is obviously a Targaryen funeral. So we see a body wrapped in a pyre, not in a pyre, on a pyre.
On a pyre.
Wrapped in a pyre. That would be weird.
This season's latest fashion is.
We see a body wrapped in a pyre, and then really sadly we see a smaller body next to it.
Which is a really upsetting scene. Mm. Obviously seeing Emma's body and Balon, the child's
little baby Balon,
which was Jaehaerys' second son who died, and his death launched all of this question about succession. Do you know what? I just thought, what about Rhaenyra? She's lost her mum. Mm. She had this fantastic close relationship with her, and she has like a ceremonious role, I guess. She calls down the dragon.
But Daemon does say to her, he's actually, for once, he's kind of sensitive. It's like the first time you ever seen him showing any kind of empathy or understanding.
I was
going
to say.
And he says, your father needs you now more than ever. And it's almost like, it is kind, but it is also a little bit like buck up, because she's feeling wretched, but she's also feeling a little bit sorry for herself.
Yeah.
Because it's once again, I'm just a girl, you know, and she says something like, was my dad happy for those few hours when he had a living son? And I think Daemon does kind of want to remind her that it's not all about her to an extent, and that she and her father need to kind of pull together in this situation.
I know, I kind of feel like we never see her get over Emma's death.
No.
I mean, clearly she does move on. There's a lot of death in GOT world, but I was glad Daemon was there.
Yeah.
Even though it was kind of a barbed message, to give that little bit of support.
Yeah, and I think he was more sensitive to his brother than we've ever seen him being before.
Yeah, totally.
So Rhaenyra tells Syrax, the first Dracarys of the season, and the bodies are burned. We then cut to the small council who are talking and they've met to talk about the succession, because nobody wants Daemon.
No.
Daemon is listening, which is very odd.
Well, I mean, this goes back to my bugbear about security.
He's just sort of standing in a corridor listening.
Yeah.
It's like, why don't they? He is still on the small council. He should possibly be in
there. There for you.
So it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But nobody wants Daemon. Also, oddly, I think, and this is one of the questions I have about Otto and his machinations, whether he actually is planning or if he just kind of comes up with ideas that he thinks will please the king. He suggests Rhaenyra. Everyone's like, ugh, a girl, ugh. And then Lord Corlys, slightly self-servingly, says, there might be other people, i.e. my wife. And everyone's like, ugh, double ugh, we already rejected her.
We've been through that.
And then the king, not unreasonably, is like, fuck the lot of you, my wife just died.
I mean, that would be my take.
Yeah, and he just walks out of the room and they are left kind of going, ugh. I mean, the thing is that by Lord Beesbury is quite right. By law and precedence, Daemon is the heir.
Yes.
Whether you like him or not is irrelevant.
Your favourite cheesecake knows his lineages.
He does. And he should just be left to be the heir. But obviously Otto doesn't trust Daemon. No one trusts Daemon. They seem to think that he's just some sort of psychopath. Also, I did notice Lord Strong, who I generally like, but I did notice that he's very anti-women, which I think reflects the wider Westerosi...
Yeah.
But we didn't talk about Lord Strong.
We didn't.
He's master of something.
He's master of the laws as well, I think.
I'm not sure.
With Daemon and Beesbury.
Hmm.
I think they're like a little policy unit.
A trio.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Lord Strong owns Harrenhal, which is the castle that we see at the beginning when they're doing the first succession vote. And he's very, very anti-women, clearly, in terms of them being
I think it's
queens.
Just generally a patriarchal society.
Yeah. But otherwise, Lord Strong doesn't say very much in this first episode. But the bits of advice that he gives are generally, I think, quite sound.
Moving on from the small council.
Otto.
Wasn't this an uncomfortable scene?
Oh, yes. Poor Alicent, who's about 14. Her father is sort of like, oh, darling, you're looking very attractive today. And she's sort of like, And he says,
what's this about?
Why don't you go and see the king and comfort him?
I mean, she knows what he's saying.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole scene is basically a father pimping out his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
To secure his power base. It's deeply uncomfortable straddling on unethical behavior. Well, it is unethical
behavior.
No,
it's totally unethical and it's also gross.
And did you just mention, why don't you put on one of your mother's...
Oh, yes.
Your
that's
dead
the
mother's
other
dresses?
Grim thing. Yeah. Why don't you wear one of your mother's dresses?
Because, you know, you might feel special then.
Everything about it is
just... It might get
just,
you in the mood.
Yeah, your dead mother's clothes are going to really make you sex you up. I mean, it's just really horrid.
How?
It's horrid.
Where are Westerosi child services when you need them?
I mean, Otto is... You sort of start this episode thinking that Otto's a bit greasy, but he's on the right side of things.
Yeah, he's the kind of like middleman. He wants to keep things stable, protect the realm against Viserys's kind of lack of leadership and Daemon's impulsiveness.
Yeah, and wild card.
But he's a schemer.
Oh, God, and a gross schemer.
And a gross schemer. Yeah,
but not like a up on the above board schemer.
I feel like that's the sort of thing someone would shout out a car at you. You're a gross schemer.
But yeah, so Alicent, thankfully, despite being young and obviously a bit worried by this command from her father, has the sense to show up to Viserys's chambers, which she actually says, in his chambers. And Otto's like, yes. Yeah. But she shows up and she's got a book.
Yeah.
And so she's going to make it about history.
Yes.
And I think that's very clever of her. We also then see Viserys's model railway.
Hiske Electrics. His giant model of old Valeria that he's been building. Yeah. I mean, we should say he hasn't done it all by himself. No. This is like the child who brings the award-winning science project to school.
The parents were
working till 12 o'clock at night in the basement to do it. So he's got this huge model of Valeria.
Yes.
And I guess he's just going to keep adding to it.
He paints it in his spare time.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's peacetime.
But also what's nice about this is that her knowledge, I mean, I don't expect that she has a ton of knowledge of the king, but clearly she knows enough about him to know that he's interested in the histories, because this model obviously says he is interested in the history of his family and where they came from. And so by bringing a history book, then it's like, I thought it might distract you, but I'm not trying to seduce you.
Yeah, I kind of feel like Alicent's way of surviving in Westeros is to always try and put a sheen on things, to see unjust and unpleasant deeds as noble in some way or part of a bigger structure. And I kind of feel her focus on history and nobility and lineage is a way of her doing that, is a way of her packaging up all of these unpleasant things that she's going to have to do as it's good for the realm.
Yes. And also, I think she does actually have a kernel of almost a sort of naive wisdom in it. She's lost her mother.
Yeah.
And she makes that little speech about, you know, when my mother died, I just wanted people would kind of be weird and evasive. And I just wanted somebody to say they were sorry.
Yeah.
And I think that does touch Viserys.
She's wise beyond her years.
But also honest. She doesn't have all that, oh, my lord.
I don't know what that is.
That's Otto.
Oh, right, okay. I thought that was an alternative route that Emily Carey could have taken in that scene.
Or that.
Dressed as a French maid. Viserys.
But no, I mean, I think she just comes across as honest and straightforward as a child, which she is.
Yeah, and she's really sweet. I mean, she sees this giant kind of model of Valeria and she doesn't think, as I would, incel.
Dork.
Unabomber. Dork. She's like, oh yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Well, I guess they didn't have a lot to do. There was no television.
Yeah, they weren't podcasting.
So we see this sort of flowering of, you know, very small bud of intimacy beginning between the king and Alicent.
That is a vile euphemism, but we will accept
Sorry.
It.
Sorry. This is Westeros. Lots of things are vile. We then go back to Daemon's favourite brothel, where...
Does the brothel have a name?
No. The brothels are in the Street of Silk,
That's it, yeah.
But there are no, we don't get individually named. The brothel scene, I watched it again last night, just kind of trying to, you know, and it's so weird, right?
It's deeply unpleasant.
It's insane. There are two people right in the middle of the room who are so well lit. They are so well lit.
They're it's on like a giant lazy Susan.
Yeah, and they might as well be in broad daylight. And it's just really, really odd. Are there no rooms that people can go to?
I was watching Mary and George recently. Have you seen that series?
I've watched a couple of episodes.
And it's very much of the time where people all just had sex in the same room.
Yeah, but did they really?
Oh, I guess they just had a completely different perspective on intimacy.
And
what was needed if you were going to get it on with someone.
Bright lighting is a bit... That's a choice by the filmmakers.
It's very Studio 54. And also the fact that, and I don't know how I didn't laugh more, the guy stops and turns around mid-thrust to listen to Damon.
To listen to Damon's speech. That's control.
That's that poor woman.
So Damon is being egged on to make a speech. And we hear part of it. We don't hear the whole thing. But this gets back to Viserys, that he said something about the dead baby.
Yeah.
This comes via Otto, of course. And he's told, Viserys is told, that Daemon has toasted the baby and said heir for the day, or heir for a day, which is obviously mocking the baby.
Yeah, heir for a day. Yeah.
Now, we don't know what Daemon actually said. So we don't know the context of that. But this is used by Otto to wind Viserys up. To the point where Viserys basically says, out, Daemon, I'm disinheriting you and I'm going to name Rhaenyra as my heir. And then he gets Rhaenyra off for a little chat and he tells her about Aegon's dream.
Yes.
Which is essentially Game of Thrones.
It is.
It's the plot of A Song of Ice and Fire.
Game of Thrones.
And as proof, he shows her Aegon's dragon, dagger. He shows her Aegon's dagger, which we will recognise.
Yes.
From Game of Thrones.
It's the dagger that the Catpaw assassin used when they tried to kill Bran Stark.
Yes.
Yeah.
And?
Well, crucially, I mean, that's how it ended up in that family. The dagger that Arya used to kill the Night King.
Exactly. So we know
which
this
didn't
dagger.
Happen in the book.
No. Well, we haven't got that far.
No, we haven't.
We will never know.
We don't know.
We may never know who kills the Night King or what with. Because there is no Night King.
R.I.P. Night King.
There is no Night King.
Well, this is the thing. That's why I'm saying it didn't happen in the book. Because one of the biggest things, when you go to the books after the TV series, you just think, sorry, where is this central figure that's kind of animating all these zombie hordes? He's not there.
Still walking really, really slowly.
I digress.
We see this dagger, and obviously we know this is important. And one of the things that Viserys says to Rhaenyra is that this is a story that's been passed down from king to heir. And he hasn't, we don't know this yet, so I won't say it actually because it's a spoiler for later on. But it's a story that's been passed down from king to heir. There has to be a Targaryen on the throne when this threat comes from the north.
Yeah.
So this is why this is so important. This is why the succession is so important. This is why he's been holding on to this. And this is why it kind of also is an interesting bit of propaganda and kind of rebranding of Aegon, that he didn't just come to Westeros to conquer. He also came to save.
Yes. Very clever.
Yeah. So it's like Aegon wasn't just selfish colonizer.
He was like, I need to put all of these bits of the puzzle in place.
Yeah.
Because when the shit hits the fan, 200 years from now, we want to be ready.
We also.
He's just thinking of us.
He
all
is
of us.
Always thinking of others. We also hear the first C-bomb of the show. And we see Viserys getting another cut from the throne. And we hear that Viserys, despite coming from a family of dragon riders and being utterly dependent on dragon power,
I found this really bizarre.
Doesn't like dragons
yeah.
and doesn't think that people should have ever tamed them or gone anywhere near them or have them or touch them or do anything with them, which seems strange.
Yeah, given that his whole family's wealth and power and status is...
Yeah, he'd be nothing without the dragon.
They're dragon lords.
Yeah. So that's an interesting take on Targaryen lore. Daemon tells Viserys that he's weak, which is fair.
No notes, Daemon.
and then he flies off on his funny dragon, Caraxes.
Yeah.
It's a wiggly, wormy thing. It's not got that chunky, solid body like the dragons that we're used to. It's very long and thin.
It's like a sand snake.
Yeah. And he takes Miseria with him.
He does.
Is not what he's supposed to be doing because he's supposed to be going back to his wife. We don't know at this point where he's going, but it would be quite unusual to rock up to see your wife with your favourite sex worker in tow.
I mean, he might leave her on the dragon in the car park and then...
That's possible.
Go into the Vale and meet Rhea at a little coffee shop or something.
A tavern. And then we see the lords and ladies of Westeros attending Rhaenyra's investiture and bending the knee to her.
Nothing's ever that simple in Westeros.
They bend the knee and they swear allegiance to her. And we, once again, we hear Starks. We hear all the names that we're so familiar with from Game of Thrones. We also see a fair amount of side-eyeing, eye-rolling, and essentially that this vow's going to last as long as it's political for it to last. We notice as well with the costumes, for the first time, that Rhaenyra is in the full Targaryen red and black.
Yes. And what about Alicent? Does she crack open the green at any point?
Not at this point.
She doesn't, does she?
No.
I was misremembering, but... Like you say, Rhaenyra's got those ceremonial colours.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think I'm assuming, because obviously her hair is very different and she's got a kind of funny hat.
Yes.
So I don't know whether that hat is...
It's very Ascot.
I don't know whether that's kind of traditional, because we do see some clothing later on in the series, which is obviously ceremonial garb that they brought over from old Valyria. And so we wonder if this is somehow kind of, you know, part of their kind of regalia that has come... Like traditional.
Yeah.
It's different to the clothes that they wear every day. And we hear Dany's theme as
we
she's
do,
crowned.
Which is fantastic to hear
and
that.
Ominous,
and
obviously.
Ominous.
Yes.
And then
Dany is not a pure figure of goodness in
she's
this
not,
world.
She's morally ambiguous. Mm. And then that's
and
the
in
end
fact,
of the episode.
Actually beyond morally ambiguous and downright evil.
She's corrupted by her power.
Yeah. She does go batshit by the end. That's what happens. Power
sound
corrupts.
Medical diagnosis. But that's where episode one, season one, comes to a close.
And there we have it.
Yeah.
So, obviously, setting up potential conflict left, right and centre, which is great. Because clearly, got girl, heir, no one's happy. What's going to happen next?
Law question. Has the Dance of the Dragon already started? The Dance of the Dragons? No.
Not yet.
That's when... Is it Aegon the Second?
Is he the Second?
Maybe. He's the son anyway.
The new Aegon.
Alicent and Viserys' son.
Yes.
When he's crowned.
Yes.
That's when it kicks off.
Yes.
Just wanted to check. Okay, yes. That's the point.
No, at this point, there's no dancing.
Dragons.
Apart from the symbolic dancing that
okay.
we get in the season. So... One of the things we thought it might be fun to do, because that's the kind of people we are.
don't check the dictionary definition of fun, please.
Is to dig a little bit deeper into some of the customs and traditions of Westeros. Now, as I say, as we all know, but I'm making a big leap there, but I think it's generally quite well known that George R. R. Martin based Westeros on Great Britain. Would it have been Great Britain? England
and the War of the Roses.
During the time of the Wars of the Roses, but I think he's pulled from other periods. But it's very much Western Europe in the medieval period.
Yeah.
And so it's quite interesting to make those comparisons with Westeros and our real world. And this week we're going to talk a little bit about jousting, as obviously it's a key scene.
It's the big central
it's
scene.
It's the central
it?
Scene
with
in this
birth.
Book. Yeah. In this book, in this season, in this episode. Ah!
Gosh. Focus, Michelle.
Focusing. It's key in this episode. So jousting is obviously very important in Westeros, as it was in the medieval period. And jousts and tourneys are held to celebrate great events, such as the birth of an heir or the appointment of a new hand. We see this happening.
Yeah.
And we also see, I think we do see some, in Renly's camp, I think we see some of the soldiers kind of casually joust. They have like a little casual joust, a mini joust.
Yeah.
Because Loras wins, and I think that's the first time Brienne wins, and that's the first time we see Brienne.
Yeah, and I guess jousting, like in medieval times, was just a way of knights keeping ready for war.
It's training.
Training.
Yeah.
And also earning honour by winning tournaments.
Completely, and money and position.
And it's a system of fighting and honour. So
as we see what happens with Sir Criston, he's made his mark now.
Yeah.
People will know who he is, whereas before he was just some rando. Cute, but rando. So in the real medieval world, jousting was a martial sport and it was also a training ground for soldiers. But as it developed, it increasingly became an elaborate kind of performance. And this is where we see like Daemon's stupid helmet.
Which is not practical.
No.
But it's all part of the theatre.
Yeah, and you would never wear that in a battle. All these sort of sticky out bits would not have been practical. It's nothing compared to the helmet that was worn by Henry VIII, who was a very keen jouster in his youth.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he was actually injured quite badly in a joust. He was in a kind of coma. And there's a theory that some of the reason why he went so weird as he got older, unreasonable and bad tempered, might have been due to those jousting injuries.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, okay. So I found this little picture of this helmet for you.
Are you going to share it with me?
I'd like you to just say what you see.
Well, the first thing I'm going to say, Michelle, is you've got a nerve showing me that. And I'm going to be sending you my therapy bill.
It's not that bad.
We have to put this in the show notes so people can see what you've inflicted on me. This is some weird steampunk helmet crossed with, it's like got ram's horns, curly ram's horns. He's got glasses that almost look like mine.
It seems to be wearing glasses, which is for no apparent reason.
I mean, that must be symbolic or something about, you know, vision or greater sight on the battlefield.
I didn't even know people had glasses in that time period.
I think they just suffered.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a gimp mask.
So
how did you even keep that on your head?
I don't know.
Sorry, listeners, that you can't see this.
Yes,
but
we will share it.
Will see it.
Yeah, I mean, it is just the strangest thing. And you're like, whoa, who designed it?
Is that real?
Yeah, you've also missed out the teeth.
Oh, yes, it's got metal teeth as well, so it can...
So it's strange, strange style.
Oh, and I can see the watermark says Royal Armouries.
Yep.
So this is from the UK archive. Okay, yep. Amazing.
Yeah.
So wow.
Damon's helmet. Positively low-key, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so obviously there's a lot of performance here. It's a lot about saying, you know, look at me, I'm amazing. And it's also about sex.
Yeah, isn't look at me, everything? I'm virile.
Yeah, isn't everything about sex, obviously, in the end. Yeah. The men are trying to impress the ladies. We hear in Game of Thrones about Rhaegar Targaryen, who is...
We do.
Danny's brother and Jon Snow's father. And how he wins this great tourney at Harrenhal and crowns Lyanna Stark Queen of Love and Beauty. And that's what triggers Robert's Rebellion. So obviously these tournaments are significant, and the relationships and the dynamics between people that form at the tournaments are also significant in the terms of the history. Now, in both Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, it's suggested that tourneys become as violent as they do because none of these men have been to war. They're children of peace.
I just think that lets them off the hook too easily, though.
Well, you'd think there would be marshals. Yeah. You'd think there would be people going, oh, he cheated. But there nobody seems to be managing.
Those actions don't fit with the kind of stereotype of a knight, which is someone who acts with the honor chivalric
code.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely. And they are, I mean, I always got the sense that jousting could potentially be violent and dangerous. Like, it's obviously dangerous. You're galloping at full speed in armor with a spear in your hand. There's potential, but not that people would actually be deliberately trying to kill you and maim you. And I guess this is where Criston kind of comes off, because he could have stoved in Daemon's head, though Daemon being the prince of the realm, that might have been a stupid thing to do. But he does step back and give him the opportunity to yield, rather than being like, it's a fight to the death. And it shouldn't be a fight to the death.
No.
That's the point. Also, you shouldn't be cheating. Daemon cheats here. Loras Tyrell cheats in Game of Thrones when he rides a mare that's in season and the mountain's stallion goes nuts.
Ah.
And then the mountain chops off its head. And I think that's the first time Sansa gets the rose-coloured spectacles ripped from her eyes.
Not everything is going to be okay.
It's not going to be pretty.
Just in terms of rules, I was reading about jousting. Alphonse the 11th of Castile, I think, which was part of Spain, came up with a number of rules in the 12th century. You heard about these?
No, so a little bit like the Marquis of Queensbury rules for boxing.
Yeah, kind of. Just like trying to give the sport, if it was referred to as a sport at that time, a little bit more structure. So he said competing knights can only run 4 courses. So you can't keep picking opponents and going at them until everyone's exhausted, which makes sense. There must be judges on both teams who are not impartial, but are there to advise on what's foul play and what's not. And crucially, if one knight drops his lance, the other must raise theirs. and not harm the unarmed
knight. Yeah, see, I don't
think
that
happens.
Which is the
complete opposite of what we see here.
Yeah, I mean, this is just out of control.
It is.
And nobody is trying to take back control. But of course, you know, riding is dangerous. Riding with lances at high speed.
I don't know how they balance
towards other people is even more dangerous. Yeah. And so there is always going to be potential for this, even when people aren't trying to kill each other. Have you read A Knight's Tale? Not the Byron Helgeland film, but the Chaucer poem.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
I mean, the characters in that end up a complete mess.
Yeah.
And one of them's basically in a coma, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And blood's everywhere and... It's quite
an incredibly
visceral.
Dangerous sport.
Mm. Out burst the blood in strong red streams, as Chaucer says.
Very visceral.
Yes. Now, apparently, English Heritage, in their wisdom, in 2016, mounted a campaign to bring back jousting as an Olympic sport. Oddly enough, the Olympic Committee preferred snowboarding.
As if, of all the years to pick... 2016, as if we didn't have enough problems without sending young men and women to their deaths.
No, there wouldn't be any women. They'd just be on the sidelines going, here's my flower. Here's a favour. Here's a little... here's a handkerchief.
For as bad as 2016 was, I mean, I'm taking it anyone could take part. Well, it never got that far, I'm guessing.
No. I think it just got to kind of the long list.
Long list.
Oh, I think generally people don't want to see people dying when they're watching the Olympics.
No, I don't think that's going to be a vote winner.
No. I mean, it's and the sponsors.
Or you're going to pick up a very different crowd.
Yeah. So, is there anything else we feel we'd like to talk about with this episode, or do we think we've covered most things?
I think we have covered a lot of ground for the first episode of season one. And I'm really looking forward to getting a lot more of that courtly intrigue in episode two.
Me too. And plus, I think next week we expand beyond King's Landing. So I like the claustrophobia, but I think some people felt that, again, can't keep comparing because they are two very different beasts. But obviously in Game of Thrones, you were up at the Wall, you were at Winterfell, you were in Essos. So, we were traveling around from different place to different place, and here we are just in King's Landing, and I think we will start to see more locations and the show will feel more expansive, and we'll also get more characters and new conflicts, and I for one cannot wait.
And thank you, Michelle, for a great chat.
Thank you, Joseph.
Looking forward to next week. And listeners, if you want to follow us on Instagram,
yes,
we have an account there, which is Greens versus Blacks Podcast, I think. Just search that and you'll find us.
Yes.
We've got the three-headed dragon sigil.
We do.
So we're on point. And thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.